So I am not an astronaut or a pilot, but I have to bring y'all back to Earth somehow. I couldn't think of a good intro to go from the space station to conversations with parents. So I guess we're just going to jump right in. I found both those topics very fascinating. The success of a teacher rises and falls on his ability to communicate. That shouldn't be too shocking. But what is not so evident is that your success as a teacher is only as good as your ability to have conversations, really. And I'd even go so far as to say that possibly your success as a teacher or as even an individual, no matter what position you find yourself in, your success is sort of governed at best by the conversations you're having poorly, or in worst case, the conversations you're not having at all. Now, I would guess that each of you probably have a conversation going on in your head that you're thinking of, that you wish would have gone better, or that you know you still have to have. What's today? Monday, going back to your school classrooms. You've been pushing it off, pushing it off, pushing it off, and it's still there. Maybe not just with parents, maybe with a student. So I'd like to broaden this maybe just slightly. I'd like to wrap up our thoughts here in this topic, specifically the teacher-parent relationship, and possibly I'd have some tips on how to work some of the tricky conversations there that we need to have at times. But a lot of my thoughts for most of our topic that we're considering here, conversations with parents, I would say works anywhere. It's just communication skills, whether it's you with your board, with your students, with parents, or elsewise in society. Another thing I'm sort of assuming here is that the topic was assigned here probably not with happy, bless you conversations in mind. Or else, I mean, usually they're not real hard. I mean, they're actually rather fun. It's not a real hard challenge to have a good conversation when things are going well and people appreciate each other and we love each other and everything's going well. Conversations are great. So why would we have conversations with parents at its very core if it's worth spending the next half hour of our life here talking about conversations? I'm assuming that we are wanting to focus on the ones that have high potential of going poorly, or conversations that have a high potential of being very stressful and people being hurt throughout them. And like I said, this is not just for teachers. This applies to everyday life. I like to think about this thought some more myself, but I'm going to throw it out there for you to chew on. I'm suspicious that relationships are built on conversations. Not sure, I didn't think that through totally yet. But what percentage of relationships are built on conversations? And I think it's a very, very high percentage. Isn't that how we form relationships? We talk. We talk to each other. And that's not just verbal. I'll touch on that later. There's other forms of conversation as well. Another thing for you to think about, as a bit of an introductory comments here. Another thing I'm proposing. Conversational competence might be the single most overlooked skill we fail to teach our students. I'm not in the classroom anymore right now, and looking back as I pondered this, I was like, you know what, I don't know how much time did I even spend with my upper grade students teaching them how to have productive, hard conversations. in-person conversations. Our students graduating can debate and lecture brilliantly and rapidly type and produce intellectually tickling articles, and our teachers rub our hands and smile behind our hand, and I was like, great, we got it done. We got the periodic table memorized, and they're just stars. But those same students and possibly their teachers cannot look another person in the eye and have a difficult conversation. I wonder if we're missing something. That leads me to my next thought. Why are conversations hard? What's the problem here? Why can't we just have good conversations? And why does there have to be tensions? Why does there have to be heightened emotions? And when you really stop to dig that apart, it gets very, very complicated very quickly. And I just tried to organize my thoughts a little bit into a few points, like, why are conversations hard? And I think we have to grapple with some of this because it helps us understand what's going on. As a general rule, and I'm putting myself right in the same category, humans tend to be petty, proud. Our pride comes in here. Self-centered. Agenda-driven. Just in general. And we might as well own it. We all are. Subconsciously, it's there. We kind of all have our own agendas we like to push. And naturally, our inclination is self-centered. We're self-preserving. We want to be well thought of. And we have thought through our opinions. And so we have thought through them very carefully, perhaps. And so they have to be right. I mean, we really thought this thing through. You see where that's going? So there's that sort of humanity, as I'll call it. Just our general humanity makes conversations difficult at times. Then there's other avenues that make conversations difficult that really have nothing to do with our fallen nature as such. It's just the way God made us. And I'm thinking of personality differences as a huge factor in conversations. And I don't know if you like to study personalities, but I personally like the DISC model, D-I-S-C. The D is dominant type of individuals. They love to get things done. They're hard drivers. They like results. They want things done now. And why are we sitting around? Let's get to work. We want results. The I stands for inspirational people. They are the life of the party. Like, come on, just forget the work we have to do. Let's just have a good time for once. Make sure everybody's is happy. And the S's are supportive. And those people are very, very in tune with relationships. And they're very worried. It's like, whoa, slow down. Like, is everyone feeling okay? We want to make sure everyone's along. We don't want to miss anybody. Are you feeling all right? What's your opinions on this? We have to talk about it. We have that type. And then the C's on the DISC, D-I-S-C, the C's are very cautious people, and they can often clash with maybe the D's or the I's, especially because C's are cautious, and they're like, whoa, like that great idea that this D personality came up with, like, that's never going to work. Did you think about this? It's going to cost too much. It's going to happen. What if? That's the train of thought they run. And so we have this, that's just the basic four. And can you see how that could add serious complications? Because if I'm the aggressive type, I want to get things done, and there's a reasonable number of school teachers that would be more down the C line, very cautious, very, very, very precise. Everything's neat. Desks are in perfect rows, not even a half inch off. Everything's neat all over the room. Just picture perfect. And if me as a parent comes in and I have a lot to do, I got a lot of things on my plate, and I come in and I have a couple things on my mind, and these can just total steamroll some of the others. You probably felt that. Didn't mean to, but it's just the difference of personalities. And vice versa. The D's and the I's can get thoroughly frustrated with the more cautious, supportive type of people. It's like, come on, let's just have a good time. Let's get stuff done. Why are we sitting talking about our feelings? I mean, that's not going to get anything done in life. So just hold that thought, all that personality stuff. And then we have another big one that comes in here, and that's general communication style. So we have our humanity, our fallen nature that adds complications. We have multiple personality types that neither of them are right or wrong. It's just different. We relate differently. And then communication styles. Some people are very auditory. They will come into your classroom, since we're talking about school teachers, and they're like, hey, I want to hear about this. How's he doing? We want to talk it over. We got to talk all this through. What's the trouble you're having? What can we do? And we talk. Others are more visual, and they'll come into your classroom, and they'll be looking at the bulletin boards, and they're like, look, I have to see this. Where's Johnny's desk? And they open the desk, and they're paging through stuff. They got to get their hands on things and start looking at it. And if the grades are bad, you can't just tell them they're bad. They have to see them. We have to flip through the book and look down the rows and see where the check marks are. That's what they want. There's also what I call more the touchy-feely type of people. They tend to be highly emotional, and those are the type that'll come in and pat you on the back and tell you how good of a job you're doing, and they're just, they're very emotional. I probably might lay their hand on your arm, and if you want to tell you something, they're just a touchy-feely type of people. And if you're not that, that's a bad deal. That's a bad deal. And they're not trying to be odd or gross. I mean, that's just them. And maybe they have to learn some things on our side, but that can be a huge clash. I like studying people types, and the high C personalities that are introverts. You pair that up with a dominant extrovert, and there'll be a volcanic, what was the thing in the ocean floor? And there'll be chemical reactions left and right. So you see how we get all this, what I call noise, between two different people. We're trying to communicate. I maybe should write on the board as well, but I'll just try to demonstrate here. You have one person and another person. We're trying to communicate this thought over to here, but we got all this noise in between. If you can picture just a bunch of odd colors in wavy forms down between these two people, and somehow we have to get through. We have to get through. We're missing it. We're missing each other. You've probably seen some of these numbers already too, how in conversation, the words you actually say aren't that critical to how the conversation goes. I've heard already that it's 10% the actual words, 20% tone of voice, and maybe up to 70% body language. Isn't that fascinating? Your actual choice of words is down into the 10-15% of impact, the actual choice of words. Everything else has to do with how you present yourself and your body language and tone of voice and all the other social cues that come into this. That's what the person's reading. So, where does that get us? Just to a more confused spot, we throw our hands up and say, there's no way we're going to get through this. How am I supposed to understand this person? But looking back over my life, and I would just encourage you, if you take an interest in people, which I hope you do if you're a school teacher, dig into some of this stuff, such as personality type and communication styles, because it was a game changer for me. When I started to understand, you know what? This person isn't trying to be a jerk. They're actually a person just like me. They just process life different. And they value maybe different things than I do. Actually, relationships and pulling this thing back and sitting down and having a one-on-one conversation where we're not rushed is like super important to them. For me, we know what to do. Let's get up and do it. But not for them. It doesn't make one person bad or one good. But somehow we're going to have to get along. So why do we cringe? Actually, I forgot one thought I added here. I grabbed a Perspectives of Truth in Literature, and this is a joy to teach out of. I miss it probably more than anything else. other than my students. Whoever drew this picture in Children of a Liar knew what they were doing as far as body language goes, and I love teaching this to my students. You might have to pull a book up yourself, but Jesus is teaching in the middle, and all these other people are around the outside. And you can stare at that picture for quite a while, and you will notice that the artist took particular pains in every single person that he drew there. You notice how Jesus, his body language, he's standing facing them straight, open-handed, his palm out, and all the others are either at an angle, and that's an aggressive stance. If you're not agreeing with somebody, you might just angle just a little bit, shoulder to them, shoulders crossed, looking at them like this, like, that's very aggressive. That sends a message. And you look at it here. A lot of their arms are crossed, or another one, standing on an angle with their hands on your hips. Again, a very aggressive stance that you might not think of right off. But there's one, hands on his hips. A lot of them are, they're all angled to Jesus. None of them are facing him straight on. They're all angled. But Jesus is the only one that's standing straight and looking at him. All the rest are on an edge or crossed, fists up, and the one person on this side has his fist balled up. Crossed, hands on the hips, all of them angled to Jesus. Anyway, just a fascinating side note, body language. So why do we cringe or avoid some of this? We know that we have this difficult conversation and we want to run. Isn't it mainly because we don't want to get hurt, or we don't want to hurt others? But it's almost a self-protection mechanism, isn't it? It's extremely vulnerable. You might get hurt. You might get the door slammed in your face. You might. And here's, I think, the core. If I can go back to my topic this morning. The core at some of this, it comes back to an identity thing again. Came full circle, because we're afraid it's going to challenge who we are as an individual. When our identity is not in Christ or in some of this other stuff, we don't want to have this conversation because it might make us look bad, and if I look bad, everything's knocked out from underneath me. So we do cringe, we do avoid. What are some tips for good conversations that I would like to touch yet? Specifically, parent-teacher communication. I mentioned identity. I will just jot it down again. To have good conversations, to be willing to have hard conversations, your identity has to be in the right place. Ephesians 2 again. And one of the best tricks, or not tricks, one of the best tips that I know of for good conversations is to really, really improve your listening skills. Did you know that good conversations are more listening than talking? By far. Listening is one of the most important talents that you could develop in yourself. Here's a quote I came across. When your mouth is open, you're not learning. Chew on that one for a little. When your mouth is open, you're not learning. Now somebody has to teach, I realize. And I'm not saying you shouldn't teach in school. Your mouth should be open and your students should be listening. But in conversations, especially with your superiors, especially with equals, even in tough conversations, listen, listen, listen more than you talk. We can talk about 225 words a minute, but we can process up to about 500. So take a look at that gap. 250 words a minute, and I'm probably not even speaking that fast. And you can process up to 500. So the gap in between 225 and 500 is called distractions in there. Can be. That's where your mind just starts going everywhere else. It takes incredible discipline to be able to be in a hard conversation and listen and focus. Do not let your mind wander. Here's another quote that I really like. Most of us don't listen with the intent to understand. Most of us don't listen with the intent to understand. We listen, here's what hurts. We listen with the intent to reply. Most of us don't listen with the intent to understand. We listen with the intent to reply, and I'm the most guilty here. You know what I mean. Person's talking and you don't agree with him. Your mind is spinning a million miles an hour of all the arguments you're stacking up as soon as he can just shut his mouth and let me speak once. Right? You're not going to connect. It's not going to happen. And it's so easy to do. It's like, oh yeah, I got him on that one. As soon as he gets done, I can say my piece and I'll prove my point. What if we were to block all that out and focus solely on the individual we're talking to, conversing with, and listen with the intent to understand? We have to empty ourselves and come with an open hand. Empty yourself, coming with an open hand. Asking good questions is another excellent, excellent method for tricky conversations. Nobody said you had to defend yourself. Somehow we convince ourselves that that's top priority. We have to defend our position. We have to make sure they understand that we got our act together and we know what we're doing. What if you would ask questions? You might learn something. But then that opens yourself up to being vulnerable because perhaps you're wrong. Perhaps you are. Perhaps you're not thinking right. Then I guess it's up to us whether we're going to be humble enough to say, hey, I want to change if I'm not right. What if the person is more correct than I thought? Are we willing to go there? Asking good questions. There's another little something for you to jot down. Lead with questions instead of statements, especially in a tricky conversations. Lead into a conversation with questions instead of making statements. Instead of saying how you believe something to be, what if we would rephrase that in a question? Say, how do you perceive this? How does this appear to you? What do you think? And then that has to be followed up by the 8-second rule. And what does that mean? You have to close your mouth for 8 seconds before you talk again. Because you know what's so easy to do? We ask this question and we already have this thought all formulated, and we pop a question to the person we're talking to, and they have to sit and process it, and you go about 1 or 2 seconds, you're already firing them. Second question, third question, you're just loading them with the stuff and they don't know what to do with it. And I've tried it. It's uncomfortable if you're not used to it, but it's actually very comforting after you can enjoy the silence. Just stop and sit there. Ask one question and sit there as long as it takes for the other person to answer. There's no rush. Sit there and wait. This works great with students, by the way. Really good with students. Upper grade teachers, especially. There's adolescent years where they're still trying to figure out how their own brains work. Ask them a good question if it's a discipline issue and just sit there. Let them think. Let them think. Don't hijack the conversation with your own story. That's so easy to do as well. A person says something like, oh yeah, that reminds me of this, and mind you go into a big story that's off topic. Don't hijack conversations. Lead with asking, follow with telling. Lead with asking, make sure you understand, and then possibly you can share your side. Using open-ended questions. How did that make you feel? How did that affect your family? When I made this decision in my classroom, I understand that this caused some frustration for your family. How did it affect you? What would you recommend that I do? A set of 4 questions that are very applicable to hard conversations, but possibly if you're the one in authority specifically, and you're struggling to connect with somebody under you, what if you were to ask them, first of all, what do you think about whatever the issue is? And then the other 3 questions are very easy. Ask what else? What else? And what else? You know what's happening through that process? When you keep digging down through the layers, okay, what else? How else do you think about this? What else are you thinking? It's going to take two or three times until you can set the platform where the child or the person is feeling emotionally safe enough to really tell you what they're thinking. Guarantee you, they will not tell you their deepest thoughts on the first question or two. You got to keep probing and peeling off those layers, and it's the second, third, or fourth time where it's like, ah, that's what you're thinking. I thought so. I thought so. All this other stuff you gave me is chaff. That's not the issue. You just named it right here. That takes a while. If you don't know, say so. If you don't know, say so. Don't claim to be an expert when you're not. And I like to give this little, possibly you know the definition of an expert. An X is something that is not, and a spurt is a drip under pressure. So be careful about calling yourself an expert. If you don't know, say so. Maybe another little tip. Conversations are not promotional opportunities. Conversations, face-to-face conversations, are not times for you to try to build a sales pitch for yourself. Stay out of the weeds would be another one. We often get hung up on this because stories are passionate to us and we understand them intimately. But did you know that most people face-to-face conversations don't care about details? What do they care about? Like the little details. Like at 3:30 we left and then we went here and then we drove 5.5 miles or kilometers and then we turned here and got a scare on this corner. Most people don't care about the minute details as much as they care about how you're making them feel and their child feel, especially in the school situation. They want to know, are they emotionally safe with you? Is their child okay? That's what they're thinking in the back of their minds. Be brief, be interested. People are the most fascinating things you will ever encounter. I hesitated to write things, but that's the quote as I had seen it, so take it for what it's worth. As we think of conversations between parents and teachers, and in our setting, conversations with parents, so I'm picturing that the initiation process comes from the teacher to the parents. That's how I'm sort of picturing this. And as I was chewing on this, I'm still trying to formulate this thought. It just came to me today. I didn't fully process it. Could it be that we're living life too stressed to be able to have buffer zones in our mental capacities to soak up some of this relational stuff? I'm thinking parents and teachers, because that's where we are here. Teachers, if we're maxed to the gills and we have a parent step into our classroom that adds just another millimeter of stress and that just snaps our string. I think we're running ourselves too tight. And the argument could be the same on the parent's side. Did you ever consider when you're tempted to feel frustrated at a parent, did you ever consider the pressure that parents are under? Like, yeah, we school teachers, we got the world's heaviest job, I know. Maybe. But parents have a load. Parents do. And I wonder sometimes in our busy lifestyles, parents and teachers alike, we are maxed to the gills in our mental capacities. We got all this stuff going and we're overloaded on both sides. And then when we come to try to face issues together, there's no room. There's no margin. Things just go sideways quickly. So just throw that out there as teachers. Let's think about that. Maybe that's a personal discipline you can build in your life, but think about it. The parents that come in, they have lives. They're not school teachers. They're parents. They got bills to pay. They got children to feed. They got a property to keep and possibly business to run. And they're stressed out, potentially. But one thing that we have going and that warms my heart is that this conversation between teachers and parents, there's a common interest here. And what is that? Somebody just call it out. The children, the child. So I think we can all assume in our Christian settings here that the parents are both 100% committed to the well-being of their child. I think that's safe to assume. And I think it's safe to assume that we as teachers are also 100% committed to the best interests of the child. At least I hope so. So we have a common meeting place there. We're both concerned about this child, both deeply concerned about it. But can we start there? I would ask another question. To whom do these children belong? Who is the final, or who is, would you say, the bottom line responsibility falls where for a child? The parents, and I appreciated the comment earlier this morning that came up on that very strongly, and I would second that emphatically. It's the parent, not the church, not the school, that's responsible for the child. They nurtured this child. They brought this child into this world, nurtured it up through to 6, 7 years old, and then they come to a school and hand their child, their beloved child, over to us as teachers for what, 6, 7 hours a day, 5 days a week for the next 10 years. So it would be my opinion that we should be very, very attentive to parents and their interests in their children at school. Parents are like anyone else. I jotted it down this way. Parents are like anyone else. They just want to be heard and want to be told the truth, whether it's favorable or not. I found that to be true. Parents just want to be heard, and they want to be told the truth, straight up, not beating around the bush. And we get so scared sometimes when we have a discipline issue or there's something that we need to convey to the parent, but we're kind of scared, we don't know how they're going to take it. I think the best route forward is to tell them straight, hey, Johnny was dishonest, I had to punish him, here's what happened, just letting you know. And it usually muddies the water if you call up. I know it's so tempting, but yes, I had to punish Johnny today. But otherwise, he's so good. I mean, he got a good grade on math yesterday. And okay, now what are we talking about? Like, if there's a discipline issue, let's focus on that. Lay it out to the parent how it was. Catch them up to date. But then definitely follow back with them and say, hey, whatever you're doing at home, whatever, you know, the punishment that we gave last week is just really working. That's all I called you for today. It's going good. And wow, how do you think that'll make parents smile? Hear a little feedback like that. But I would recommend keeping the discipline issues, a discipline conversation, especially a phone call. Just be short and brief. Tell them what happened. Doesn't have to be a whole lot more than that unless the parent wants to talk. But then make sure you follow back before and after. Don't just be a bearer of bad news that, oh, sister so-and-so is calling. Oh, I must have got paddled again today. Should be more than that. Should be more. I jotted it down this way. Don't sugarcoat, but be kind. Don't sugarcoat, but be kind. Listen, listen, listen is another point I have. Listen at church. You can learn, especially if you're out of the area and teaching in a local community that you didn't grow up in and you're going to church there, just listen to the congregation talk. That is fascinating. You can learn a lot. Listen at church, listen in the homes, listen in the classroom. You have so much to learn. If you have married siblings that are parents or something, that's another incredible asset. You got a front row seat to how parents like to be involved. Ask them. Listen to your married friends if you're single. Another point, hopefully, ideally, you should have a principal or a school board that's backing you up. And don't forget to use that. I know not always is that the ideal situation, but hopefully you have somebody trusted that you can fall back on. I've jotted down here too. It's probably best for a teacher to stay out of home issues. I know you care so much about the home and you have insights there, and it's awfully easy to get into the weeds on that. I'm not saying it never is appropriate, but as a general rule, just be cautious about that. If you see a major home issue that you feel needs attention, possibly share that with your chairman or principal or some other person that you know that would be in a position to help them. Remember, you're not the final responsibility for the child. Sometimes there's parents that are just a struggle. You're just not on the same page. Your value systems are different. Remember, you can only do what you can do inside your classroom, and let it at that. My last quote here. Being heard is so close to being loved, it's indistinguishable. Being heard is so close to being loved, it's indistinguishable. So I give you the challenge. I don't know what your situation is, but I know with school teaching, conversations can be difficult. Students to teachers and teachers to parents and board, there can be a lot of highly sensitive information and emotions that run through that. I give you the challenge. You might think, hey, if the parent would just relate to me differently, it'd be a lot easier. I give you the challenge to take responsibility for it. Go ahead, be the adult in the room, even if the parent isn't. Take responsibility, study into personalities, study into what makes your parents tick, and always remember that the child is theirs and not yours.